Hi, it's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching, the television podcast from Vanity Fair. We cover entire seasons of the hottest shows on TV, and right now we are diving deep into House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones prequel series on HBO. I'm Josh Wigler, and here to discuss House of the Dragon episode 8, it's Richard Lawson. Richard, we got to wag our tongues and talk House of the Dragon this week.
Yeah, a lot of tongue wagging to be done. A lot of kids to sort out.
Yeah, sure.
You know, new actors yet again. Those poor other kids only got a really short time on the show.
It was brief.
Yeah, but yeah. Impactful.
Yes. We are cycling through actors very quickly on this show. But certainly Aemond himself made a real impression last week. But we've got a whole new crop of actors playing these characters as we have time jumped yet again. Stop us if you've heard this one. It appears we are 6 years beyond Driftmark at this point. Is your nose starting to bleed, Richard? Are we playing by the Lost rules here? Are we just do we need to get some sort of frozen donkey wheel back on its hinge in order to stop all of this?
Yeah, I didn't really like the polar bear in this episode.
Yeah,
I can kind of foresee some backlash against yet another time jump, but I kind of like that it's experimenting with like novelistic dimensions, you know.
Yes.
Like decades spanning kind of narrative. You do wonder, like, okay, if they're jumping this many decades in the first season, we're not even, you know, we still have a couple episodes left, what is the next season going to look like? Will it slow down? Will it kind of take on the same shape? Like, how far are we going to go into this stuff, into these many years to come before Daenerys arrives? So I'm curious about it, but like, I don't know. I like kind of filling in the blanks about what happened in the spaces between.
You like that being left to us, the viewer, rather than seeing that.
Unless there's like big stuff that you know from the book that is like really worthy of being on film and that now isn't because they've skipped over it.
Sure.
Think otherwise it feels like, I like, you know, this is kind of how like normal life works, is that you have big moments every couple years and then there's a lot of just sort of regular life in between.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely, you know, there's material that's left on the floor that I would love to have seen. But I think you could say that about almost any adaptation anyway. And I think especially with the book that is being adapted, it's less the book that's being adapted and more a period of fake history that's
right.
Being adapted. And so I do think we're getting the relevant bits. You know, I could complain about certain things here and there, but by and large, I do think we're getting served the most important stuff, and this was a really important jump into the future because somehow, some way, Viserys Targaryen has held on all these years, and maybe, Richard, just maybe, he is letting go by the end of this episode. At the very least, he is acknowledging the inevitability of his looming demise during that feast. Where we get the strong toast and everything is peaceful until it very much is not. What was your sort of vibe? I'm trying to be careful around this. What was your vibe about Viserys in this episode and the way that the episode was sort of structuring Paddy Considine's place in the proceedings?
Well, I mean, hard to watch. You know, anytime there's a character who's in such physical torment or, you know, with a hacking cough, or in this case, half rotted face, you know, and also, you know, probably a cough. it's tough. And like, you know, I'm sure that Patty Considine, like, that's a big acting challenge to sort of sell that credibly. And I think he does. I think there is something potent and almost poignant about like Viserys's, you know, survival well past what we thought it was going to be, and probably what people around him in the show thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
In that, like, all of these characters have had a sort of delayed, you know, delayed moment where they're going to kind of spring into action, you know, because
right.
presumably all of this is really going to get going once Viserys dies and Rhaenyra tries to take possession of the throne, and then everyone challenges it. And everyone's been waiting about that for like 15 years now, longer, you know. And I think there's something kind of interesting about these characters, you know, Viserys's offspring, grandkids, children, other relatives, kind of having waited in anticipation for so long that that's just become life. And now they're finally way past where they thought it was going to be, confronted with like, okay, now things are moving. And I thought that was an interesting way to position this season. And we only have two more episodes left, that like, this is kind of about a lead up to, it's not about the actual, necessarily the events themselves,
right.
I guess.
I think it's a really instructive episode in a lot of ways. I think one of the ways in which it's an instructive episode is it's, you know, we're using this matter of who will succeed Corlys Velaryon as the Lord of the Tides, should it come to pass that he does not survive his injury we hear about, we do not see. This is a great way of sort of, you know, playing out what this drama could look like if there is this question of who's going to be the ruler of Westeros, who is going to be sitting on the Iron Throne once Viserys is gone. And then the other way in which it's instructive is beyond settling this matter of who will sit on the Driftwood throne. It is really quite literally what will happen when Viserys Targaryen leaves the room, right?
Right.
You know, he's in the room, he's in control over this, this Last Supper of sorts, I think is an easy analog for how this is laid out. What happens when he leaves? Any fragile piece, is that going to last? Or is someone like an Aemond Targaryen just going to say the wrong quip at the wrong time and break that piece? So I think that there are a lot of ways in which this episode feels like the stakes that we know exist and have been warned about for so long, from Otto Hightower to everyone in between, that we are now seeing like what this might look like, and that it feels really imminent. And I know we've said that a bunch, you know, and I know that the show has sort of positioned us, you know, when we moved on from young Rhaenyra and young Alicent deeper into the future, that, oh my God, I can't believe this is all still going on. But it really looks like we are on the precipice of this thing popping off by the end of this episode.
And I think we're finding characters, I mean, at least Alicent and Rhaenyra, sad about that, you know, because as much as there's been tension between their families and, as you know, violent at times tensions, I think they maybe were kind of hoping that like the shoe would never drop, you know, because it hadn't dropped for so long, and they got complacent. And you see, on, I think, you know, both great performances, you know, you see on their faces like this kind of sudden like return to dread that they haven't maybe felt in as powerfully in many years. I think that's really well synthesized in this episode, and also gives us a lot of you know, sort of thematic satisfaction, I think, to what we've watched thus far. This show is actually really was about these people this season anyway. It was about the throne and the succession and all that, but really it was about kind of spending time with people in this sort of liminal state.
Yeah. Because, I mean, if we're going to get into a, you know, a big war heavy storyline, I think you do want to be invested in who's on either side of the aisle. And you can talk all you want, and I think people would, you know, it would be, you know, probably something that's, you know, worth a conversation about of, have we spent too much time in this lead up, in this build up, or is it the exact right amount of time to get you as nervous as these characters? You know, I mean, it's taking longer for us than we expected. Imagine living in their shoes, in Alicent and Rhaenyra's shoes. So I feel like art imitating life, or life imitating art in that sense. We'll talk about it all. It's Lord of the Tides, episode 8. We are going to recap it scene by scene. Of course, we would love to hear feedback from all of you as well. If you want to write in, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Send it in, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We will dissect The Lord of the Tides right after this quick break.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, Richard, we are in it now. House of the Dragon, Episode 8, The Lord of the Tides, directed by Geeta V. Patel, written by Eileen Shim. And we begin, you know, physically where we left off, but 6 years down the line as we are once again at Driftmark. And we are hearing about an off-screen injury. Rhaenys and Corlys have been estranged from one another for some time. It seems like the ways that they have dealt with the apparent death of their son so quickly after the actual death of their daughter, they are processing it differently. The Sea Snake has gone back to war, and Rhaenys is sitting on the Driftwood throne. And during this period of war, the Sea Snake has suffered some sort of grievous injury, Richard. Stabbed in the neck, he has a fever, he's on his way, but everyone's wondering, are we actually going to see the Sea Snake, or are we just going to greet an empty ship when it comes into port?
Yes, which, you know, I think this episode doesn't, there's no like title card that says 6 years later, you know, like it kind of fools you into thinking we're picking up right where we ended. And then through context clues, we have to understand. And I think it's a really interesting choice to have this major character have this big off screen thing happen, you know, fate unknown, because, you know, I guess it, I don't know, it kind of helps further illustrate how precarious all of this stuff is. And like, there is stuff happening outside of these castles that have, you know, major impacts on these people's lives. And I don't know, I'm curious, because aren't we sort of supposed to think that this guy's getting a spinoff? So like,
yeah, right.
What does that mean? Is it a prequel? Is it about this event, this misadventure that ends in injury? I don't know.
Yeah. So I believe that the common thinking is the Sea Snake show would be the adventures of the young Sea Snake.
Okay.
You know, the young Indiana Jones of it all. So we would see his exploits as he has traveled far and wide, you know, further than any known man in the world of ice and fire, all the way to Ashai and beyond, maybe. So I think we would see a lot of his voyages through that show. I've wondered, I don't remember if we talked about this last week, but with Laenor being left alive, you know, could there be some sort of secret Laenor spinoff? I think would be pretty fun. Or some way to maybe, you know, tell a story across two points in time, I think could be fun. But as far as we know, it is sort of like that Avengers Endgame thing where you're like, but Black Widow's coming out, she's going to be fine. And then it's like, right. I don't know. You know, we could be in a similar situation with the Sea Snake.
Yeah. And, you know, depending on what happens to him in this show's world, like, I don't know, there's something about the sort of the Lord of the Tides. That's sort of like, you know, there's inevitable ebb and flow and, you know, high and low. And I just think there's something kind of poetic about him off screen on yet another one of his sea skirmishes. You know, it finally caught up with him, you know, like he it's sort of a testament to his sort of stubborn nature that he would be back at it yet again. And finally, you know, he doesn't win.
Right. That being said, I think it would be pretty disappointing if Steve Toussaint just kind of left the show.
I don't think that's what's going to happen.
Sort of resolution there. Yeah. So if someone out there is like, I'd be really frustrated about that, I'm right there with you. I would be frustrated as well. I think we're going to be okay. I think we'll have a little more to do in that storyline. We will not have more to do with his brother by the end of this episode, but it is a big one for Vaemond Valerion, who is taking the news of his brother's potentially fatal wound as a signal to start making some moves of his own. And this was seeded at least as far back as last week, Richard, when he was giving the eulogy for Laena and talking about how the blood of House Valerion, the true blood of House Valerion, runs deep as he's just eyeing Rhaenyra and the kids. And he's really all about that this time around. He's telling Rhaenys that he should be the one to step up. Luke Valerion, he is the second son of Rhaenyra and Laenor, ostensibly. And he is supposed to take the Driftwood throne. But Vaemond is saying that this should not be a matter of the history books, which is what my brother cares about. This should be a matter of blood and what's going to happen to the Valerion line. We're just going to sit aside and watch it get snuffed out by House Strong. So he's, you know, speaking a really big game that if he were to speak this publicly, as we come to find out, might be a huge issue. But he feels like he is backed by the current state of King's Landing, which we'll come to see is really largely dominated by the Hightowers right now.
Yeah. And people, look, people feel emboldened to speak out against things when they think that the power structure is weakened, you know, and
right.
We have a king who is basically wasted away. And yes, his wife and his, you know, hand are sort of running the show, and they're not, you know, they're formidable. But like, I think you see like the cracks in Viserys's hold on things very clearly here, where someone like Vaemond, granted, he's not in his presence, but like he's with his cousin. And says these things out loud because it's like, well, what is he going to do to me? You know, and then
right.
We kind of later find out what someone does to him.
Yeah, exactly. I do like that the queen who never was, Rhaenys, is saying to him, this kind of talk, my cousin would have your tongue. And I'm sitting here being like, oh, she knows her cousin so well. She really knows him very
yeah,
well.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the first thing he says. Meanwhile, back on Dragonstone, we are 6 years into the marriage of Rhaenyra and Daemon. Daemon is going hunting for dragon eggs. He's very thrilled to see that Syrax, that's Rhaenyra's dragon, has produced a fresh clutch of eggs. I just wish that Dr. Ian Malcolm was in this scene, Richard, when Daemon procures the eggs. I feel like he would have a memorable one-liner to say in this moment in time.
Or Ellen Ripley, you know, mm-hmm. for a different genre turn, you know.
That would be more Dragonfire would be involved. Yeah, that'd be very, very good. So we also are now getting word about what's happened to the Sea Snake, to the Dragonstone side of the line. And Daemon is hearing from his daughter, from Bela, who is currently with Rhaenys on Driftmark, you know, clearly just sort of learning the ropes and potentially being groomed as Rhaenys wants her, wants Laena's line to be the one that continues over Driftmark. Seems like this matter is really unsettled, right? She has the thing that she wants, her husband has what he wants, and Vaemond has his own agenda as well. But Bela being there is able to get the word out to Daemon and Rhaenyra, so they're now caught up on, okay, there's some drama here, and I guess we got to get back into the drama.
For my own purposes, I want to clarify this. Bela is both Rhaenyra's cousin and stepdaughter.
Correct.
Okay.
So Daemon's daughter is
from
Bela.
Laena.
And now Rhaenyra is her stepmother as well. It is hard to track this family tree. And this episode is not making it much easier, Richard.
Well, just because they keep marrying each other, and so you're like stepmom and cousin. Okay, got it. Yeah.
Yeah, by the end of this episode, we are going to have Bela and Rhaena are going to be betrothed to their cousins / stepbrothers. This is gonna be a whole mess of things. The resume is packed.
It's a lot. Yeah.
It's a lot. So we see that that Jace is trying to learn. He's obviously older. We're 6 years down the line, so we've got new actors playing Jace and Luke. Harry Collette is playing Jace, and he's learning High Valyrian. He's trying to get himself ready for the day that he one day potentially will be the king of Westeros. He is not doing so well with his Valyrian lessons. Rhaenyra says, "You're not supposed to learn it in a day unless you plan on deposing me." And I think like the audience might be like, given the way that this show goes, I don't know, maybe it's possible. Yeah.
It is funny that, and this is borne out throughout the episode and certainly last week too, like that Rhaenyra, who when we first met her was the fiery kind of transgressive one, and Alicent was the meek sort of, you know, polite one and sort of did as she was told.
Yeah.
That now Rhaenyra's sons are sort of more dutiful, like good, upstanding boys, and Allison's kids are like a nightmare. Like, you know, it's just a funny reversal of like, is a pretty like good shorthand for like generational difference, you know?
Totally. Yeah.
But also, I think that the Valyrian, the struggling with that is like, maybe there's some sort of faint implication that like, because he's not full Valyrian, you know, he has this sort of more like, salt of the earth, strong genes in him. And so this stuff doesn't come as naturally to him.
Yeah. If he had had his father, if he had had the Valyrian blood,
yeah.
Who knows if these lessons would be taking more easily. I feel like Valyrian is probably just a really hard language to learn, would be my guess.
Like English. From everyone who doesn't speak English natively, it says that it's probably one of the hardest languages to learn.
You can, I believe. I think it is still something you can do. It was on Duolingo once upon a time.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, maybe an off-season project for us, Richard. And then next season, when we come back for season two, we can do half the podcast in Valyrian together.
Oh, perfect. From that Game of Thrones cruise where that's all they speak, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I think that's going to be great. So Daemon comes to Rhaenyra with the note about what Vaemon is planning. And it turns out that Rhaenys is going to be flying to court to give her side of things. And Rhaenyra feels like, well, she's got to be on our side about this, right? And Daemon's like, well, she does think we killed her son.
Right.
And he was like, that's an interesting point. This might be a difficult situation. They're going to have to go to King's Landing and sort this out themselves. Also worth noting, when Daemon and Rhaenyra make the choice to go to King's Landing, Daemon puts his hand on Rhaenyra's belly. She is pregnant at this moment in time. The two of them, Rhaenyra and Daemon, have two children already that we will see in this episode. And there is a third on the way.
That's five kids for Rhaenyra. No, six. Six.
It's a lot of kids. Yes, right? It's six. It would be her sixth okay. child wow. right now. Yeah. And then there's the step siblings. There's a huge family. Huge family. Yeah. The Targaryens.
And now they're all coming of age, which is when things get dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So we do see them arrive in King's Landing, and it is their first time in King's Landing in many years. It seems like it might even be their first time since they left, since Rhaenyra left for Dragonstone in the first place. And there's like no one there to greet them. We're going to later hear during the small council in a moment, Otto Hightower be like, did you, have the greeting party that's fitting of their station ready to go?
Right.
And the answer is, yeah, I guess what's fitting of their station is three people.
Right. Right. Nothing grand, nothing warm, just a clear, statement of feeling about them being there.
I think a lot of this episode, Richard, I'd be curious for your take. It feels to me a lot of like Rhaenyra recognizing I've been gone for a long time. People have forgotten me. The vipers have been able to sort of sink their teeth into this place while I've been gone. Does anyone even want me here? And do I even want to be here myself?
Yeah.
Stranger in a strange land and all.
I think the latter question is the big one in this episode, especially the scene later when she's sitting on her father's bed, kind of weeping, is like, wait, why did I want this? Like, should I just go home? Should I have come here at all? I think she knows, unfortunately, that by showing up, that she has re-entered herself irrevocably into the game,
Right.
And look, that's not to say that had they just hid out in Dragonstone for the whole, like, someone would have come for them, they were going to be a threat no matter what. She wasn't out completely, but like, she's now right back in the center of it. And you see all of the time that's passed. It's like, she's gotten used to not being in it. And it probably is scary and whatever else to be back in it.
Yeah. And it's pretty clear pretty quickly that the situation has changed greatly. Daemon is going to call Allison on this in a little while, but a lot of the Targaryen imagery has been stripped in favor of the symbol of the Seven, the great religion of Westeros, of so much of Westeros, that is what is, you see like the star emblazoned on so many different corners of the castle of the Red Keep. And so it's like literally unrecognizable to these two Targaryens as they're coming back for the first time. And even in the small council, much is the same. Lord Beesbury is still here and he's still just rambling and making no sense. Otto is still here. Otto is still whispering sweet nothings into the ear of the council, except that he's able to do it a little bit loudly. You know, he's able to be a little more full volume as he and Alicent are really the ones who seem to be running things at this point. We have yet to see Viserys at this point in the episode, but in the small council scene, Alicent is really in that top chair.
Right. Yeah. It's like, you know, Batman Begins, the board running Wayne mm-hmm. Enterprises, and then Bruce shows up and they're like, oh, right, you.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Viserys, you could forgive if he was asleep in one of the chairs at the boardroom, right. I feel like, yeah. at this point. Yeah. So we're going to see Viserys now as Rhaenyra and Daemon. Oh, really quickly, there is this moment that I appreciated greatly as a book reader. Alicent is going to be leaving the small council room. She's going to hear that something is going on with her son. And one of the members of the Kingsguard is going to inform her about this. And she says, thank you, Eric. And this man says, no, I'm Eric, actually, not Eric. And the reason being, Richard, we have just met one of our next set of twins on the show. Step aside, Lannister twins. We've got Eric and Eric Cargill in the building, two of the newest members of the Kingsguard. And this time, unlike Jason and Tywin Lannister, these are going to be played by different actors. Actual twin brothers, Elliot and Luke Tittensor, are going to be playing the brothers Cargill.
Are they people we should keep an awareness of? Like, are they... Do you think they're going to emerge as something, or are they just kind of little side characters?
Depends on how much they want to pull from the book. They okay. will either be more Easter eggy, or they might have like one of my favorite moments of the show is okay. possible. It depends intriguing. On what they want to adapt. They're not going to be humongously major players, I don't think. But I do think if they want to lean into them as characters and elaborate that on them quite a bit, then they could have some fun with Eric and Eric. I really like these characters quite a bit. I was kind of surprised, frankly, to see this on the show at all. It feels like the kind of thing that I still lament the loss of Strong Belwas from A Song of Ice and Fire, not making it into Game of Thrones. I could have imagined the world where the Cargill brothers were not brought into House of the Dragon. So right. fun to see them here.
And if nothing else, they exist in this episode as a funny meta joke about how everyone on the show has some variation of the same name.
Well, it's funny because it's a joke, but it also ends up being something of a plot device by the end of this episode, like.
That's
so,
true.
You know, we're kind of setting that up already in this tongue-in-cheek way. Shouldn't be making jokes about tongues at this point in time. Rhaenyra and Daemon, they are going to go and see Viserys. And so this is our first look at Paddy Considine in this episode. And, you know, he has been looking worse and worse and worse as time has gone on. This is a man who is really right there at the edge. He is skeletal. His hair is gone. He is missing an eye, though it is currently wrapped. He looks it's really, really, frankly upsetting. Everything that's going on with Viserys in this episode, and just the absence of his mind and not being able to see or recognize or remember people. All of this, I thought, was really, really sad when Daemon and Rhaenyra reach Viserys for the first time in probably half a decade at this point.
And he seems so far gone that he's, you know, you kind of you tense up a little bit expecting him to be like, get out of my chambers, you know, you traitors or whatever.
Right.
But he doesn't care. You know, he knows that the most important thing is keeping these people from killing each other. And he also knows that his any power he had to do that is swiftly running out. And I think, yeah, I mean, like Viserys has been this fascinating, tragic character throughout the whole season. And I think this being his final act is, certainly not what I saw coming a few episodes right. ago, but really fitting.
Yeah. So he's not doing so well. He is not really able to focus on what Rhaenyra and Daemon are actually here for. They're trying to tell him that the Sea Snake has been wounded in the Stepstones. And Viserys is like, didn't we fight that war? And Daemon's like, yeah, I know. It's the Triarchy again. They're coming back. They're really trying to make the Triarchy happen. There's new fighting. So that's what happened to the Sea Snake. And now there's this petition to decide on the heir to the Driftwood throne. And we need you to affirm your decision for Luke. And again, just Viserys demonstrating how present he is. He once again just has to ask, did something happen to Lord Corlys? So in this moment, you know, this person who they really need on their side, if they're going to be able to keep Luke in place. And keeping Luke in place and keeping Driftmark in their hands is going to be instrumental if they want to have any kind of chance of having real authority towards their claim for the Iron Throne. This man is a lifeline for that, Richard, and he can't focus in the meeting, and that's tough.
Yeah,
it's tough. But he has grandchildren. He has new grandchildren to meet, and we're meeting them as well for the first time as Daemon and Rhaenyra are introducing Viserys to their two children together. There is yet another Aegon to take into account. So there is yet another baby Aegon on board here in House of the Dragon. And there is a baby Viserys. And he's really, you know, an infant. And the Viserys that we've come to know over the course of this show, this feels like this wakes him up, at least for a little while. He has this emotional moment where he says, that is a name fit for a king. And I thought that that was really sweet until, sadly, the scene kind of turns where the babies are scared to look upon Viserys, and Viserys is so weak and his head is pounding and he starts moaning. It's brutal. This was a really, really tough scene.
Yeah. Brilliantly acted. But like, also there's something a little, I don't know, sad in the line about name fit for a king, where it's like that kid is like 10th on the line of succession.
Yeah,
that's never going to happen unless, well, I mean, I guess it could.
Right. I mean, I think back to what Luke said in Driftmark. It's like, I don't want to be king. If I'm king, that means all of you are dead.
Right, exactly.
You know, you imagine Viserys, baby Viserys, maybe feeling similarly.
Yeah, like having a list being like, okay, who would have to be dead for me to become king? It's many, many people.
Yeah. It'd be rough. Okay, let's go to Alicent, and there is a scene here where Alicent hears from a serving girl named Diana, who apparently it seems like has been assaulted by Aegon, and this is a lot. This scene of Alicent telling Diana that I believe you, this wasn't your fault, but I worry about what others might believe.
Yeah, it's very college administration, you know, telling people. Like, well, we could do something, but think of all the things it would, you know, all the problems it would cause. And,
right.
You know, I mean, this is a bad kid that she has raised.
Yes.
And now it's not just petulant, you know, whatever he was doing in his early teen years. He's like now like harming people very, you know, significantly. And,
right.
And yet Alicent can't really, you know, push him away. He is of some value to her, strategically, at least, you know.
Also, you know, he's her son, you know, not for nothing. And I think, again, I think a lot of what's happening on the show right now is Alicent has a lot of what we've seen from adult Alicent is so much modeled after the way that she was raised by her father. And she's bringing that down, like the tension, the stakes of if we don't have our act together, we could get wiped out by Rhaenyra and all of these people. And Aegon is going to tell her, you know, a scene from now, that I didn't ask for any of this. It's too much pressure. And like, that's not at all even remotely excusing the way that he is behaving. But it's just these two scenes back to back, I think, give a lot of insight into why are we even doing any of this? Why does anyone want the throne in this episode is a question that I walk away with.
Yeah, it's a curse, you know,
yes.
And it's one that some people handle better than others. But like, yeah, I think also, you know, Aegon, kind of, you know, having this breakdown or, you know, emotional fit that maybe was a little bit faked or whatever. Like, and it does seem to kind of work on Alice. She's mad at him, but like you do see the sympathy slightly return, you know. It just there's a complicated relationship there, obviously.
Right. I think that there's probably some self-loathing there of like, made you. Like,
yeah,
I
like
created
this is on
this.
Me, you know. Yeah. And like, right. I don't imagine Viserys was the most like present father when the boy was younger. And are we supposed to think that Diana was poisoned?
I had that question as well. I was certainly afraid that that was what was happening here. But I think that it is once again the moon tea. I think it is, you know, their morning after remedy
right.
that we've
right.
seen
That's
a few
what
times.
I, yeah.
You know, I don't think that Alicent is killing this woman, but you know, I definitely was concerned. I think we would have gotten some kind of follow up scene if that had been the case.
Yeah, you know, and it, I guess also this feels like a first time, maybe, that at least that Alicent's been aware of.
Right.
Or does it? Yeah, right. Because it didn't seem like, okay, I could get the tea again, you know, yet another one of these. This felt like significant, like in in Aegon's kind of progression into know, villainy, I guess.
I think that the way that she responds to it when she's alone with Aegon suggests that to me, that this has not been like, I mean, it might be a regular occurrence, but it might be the first time that this regular occurrence is pinging on her radar.
Right.
We come to find out that Aegon and Helaena, as threatened, have been married to one another. So brother and sister in the Targaryen family, as per tradition, have wed. Helaena comes into the room saying, have any of you seen Diana? She's supposed to dress our children. This is the show telling us that Aegon and Helaena are not only married, but they have produced children together at this point.
And Helaena, you know, true to her earlier characterization, is a bit of an oddball, you know. We see that more of that later in the episode. Like, I'm very curious about that character. I mean, maybe she's just kind of there to kind of add texture to it, but like, she's in a significant position too. And I'm curious what the show is going to do with her.
Yeah. We get the first scene between Alicent, Rhaenyra, and Daemon of this episode, the first time the three of them have been together since that very dramatic scene at Driftmark last week. A lot of, you know, like pot shots being taken at each other in this. Alicent, you were too busy to greet us upon our arrival. You were too busy ruling. How have you been expressing the king's wisdom? Through grunts and wheezes. You know, now that Daemon and Rhaenyra know that Viserys is not supremely capable of getting his point across at this point. So there's just a lot of tension in this room.
Yeah. And a very complicated old tension, you know. And I think by the time we get to the banquet scene later on, like, you see that weariness of that. They're just like, oh, my God, I can't believe we're still doing this.
Yeah.
But they do. I mean, Daemon and Rhaenyra certainly do have a point. Like, this is not a guy who is confidently barking out orders from bed. Like, you guys must be making a lot of this up on your own.
Yeah. Like, how are you translating any of that into like actual, policy? So, it's a worthy question at this point. I think it's interesting that, and we caught glimpses of this, I think, at the small council scene earlier, and coming up in a second here when Alicent and Otto are with Vaemond, and Vaemond is saying like, you know, the realm has enjoyed a long peace. I think that this is Otto who says it. There's the threat of war that's looming and it could arrive at our shores. And if it does, who do we want at the command of the greatest fleet of Westeros? Do you want a child or do you want someone who's going to be loyal to us? Do you want Vaemond on the throne? And so there's a strong case that's being made for why it should be Vaemond who, even if it's not supposed to go to him, why he should be sitting on the Driftwood throne. But such a decree, and the decree is going to fall to Alicent and Otto, as Alicent tells to Rhaenyra and Daemon, that we will be the ones who are making this call. It's a reach, right? You know, it is a grab. It is a move. And it's not one that you can really take back. And it is not one that is keeping with tradition. And it will certainly signal, and its reception will certainly signal, like, how far can we push this? You know, who's on our side? Who's not? If this is going to hold, then that really weakens Rhaenyra to the point that she might not have a shot at any of this anymore. And in fact, could be greatly endangered at that point in time. So the stakes are once again becoming very, very clear. But I think it's compelling that Alicent seems to be processing the impact of this, the possible impact of this as well, of being the person who is in that chair, Richard, and knowing like, if I do this, if I give this to Vaemond, it's on.
That's it.
And yeah. I don't know that I want to do that, but I might have to do that.
Especially because, like I said earlier, like everyone has been waiting to make these moves for a long time. And I think in that time have started to kind of question those moves and question the motivations behind them and question whether they even want the thing that they're supposed to want.
Yes.
And now Alicent and everybody really is like, okay, here we go. Like, it's finally here. You know, we never thought that we were going to get Avatar 2, and now it's coming out.
Yeah,
and
the Way of the Water would have been another great name for this episode.
It's true.
Yeah. Okay, so let us then go to the fighting yards. Jason, Luke are back in King's Landing as well for the first time since they were children, and they're doing kind of the stroll down memory lane. Oh, look, that's the hole where Criston Cole swung his Morningstar. I told you you'd still be here. We also come to find out that at this point in time, Luke seems to be old enough, Richard, to understand at least the rumors, if not the reality, of who their biological father was.
Yeah.
There's some talk about the memory of Sir Harwin Strong.
Yeah, he's aware of it, but, you know, they've been elsewhere. They've been in their own little world. And so it maybe it mattered less. And now that they're right back where it matters most, I don't think that the kids are maybe necessarily prepared to deal with that.
They're definitely not prepared to deal with their Uncle Aemond. As we see how time has treated Aemond Targaryen since last we saw him, he had claimed the largest dragon in the land. Luke had claimed Aemond's eye. And now, played by Ewan Mitchell, Aemond Targaryen is a young man grown, and he is very good in a fight. He bests Criston Cole in this quick skirmish where neither of them seem to be holding back. Criston yeah. Cole talking about his Morningstar. You are seeing him swinging this thing at full volume at Aemond. And Aemond is able to dodge it left and right. He ends this little sparring match with Criston Cole at sword point. Criston tells him, "You're going to win tournaments in no time." And Aemond tells Criston, "I don't give a shit about tournaments." So we know a lot about Aemond Targaryen in this one scene.
Yeah. Well, we also, he is Westeros' number one sky captain in the World of Tomorrow cosplayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He looks
which is
great.
A big,
yeah.
Big distinction. Yeah. It's a lot of look for
the
show.
El Driver. El yeah. Driver was on my mind.
Oh, very El Driver. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. With the long blonde hair. That's true. That's yes, very true. Yep. And he's got a really striking face, this actor. So
I don't know if my whistling is going to translate to the podcast. So I'm going to hold back. But you know what I'm thinking.
If you look down, there's a black mamba snake at your feet right now. So be careful.
I'm trying to be careful. I think that in addition to claiming Vhagar the dragon, Richard, it is possible that Aemond has claimed the word nephews for the rest of time. The way that he spits out the word nephews, have you come to train? And he's going to say nephews again later in the episode. And I don't think that I'll ever see that word again and not think of Aemond Targaryen.
Yeah. He wields it. He wields it heavily, but well.
Yeah, I mean, it is so it's so patronizing. It's so demoralizing. It sounds dangerous. The way that he hasn't acknowledged their presence yet, and Luke and Jace are kind of just watching. Seemingly, the first time that they've seen him since everything went down, and he doesn't greet them warmly. He doesn't greet them with anything other than a very cold, sharp acknowledgement as his nephews. It's, you know, it's an act of dominance for sure. And I think, Aemond has announced himself as a pretty dangerous person already in this one scene, and it will only get deadlier as the episode goes on. Aemond, by the way, is thrilled to see Vaemond Valerion show up as, Vaemond's entire procession rolls into town. Pretty clear the outcome that he is rooting for at this moment in time.
Yeah, he's at least... once in a while you have a character who is vocal about exactly what side they're mm-hmm. on, and that
he's
helps,
pretty clear. Yeah,
helps clarify things. Even though Aemond is pretty far down that line of succession, but like, I don't think that much matters to him. Just like he doesn't care about tournaments.
No. So then we get the scene with Vaemond and Alicent and Otto, which I feel like we've already covered. Vaemond is just making it very clear to them that whoever you pick as the next Lord of the Tides, they're going to be pretty in your debt. So we'll Driftmark. Right. So you might want to think about going with me. So it's definitely a top of mind decision for the High Towers. Meanwhile, three women named Rhaenyra, Rhaena, and Rhaenys walk into a bar. This is hilarious. Yeah. This feels like a gag to some degree, Richard, of like, we have to have a scene that's just the three people that are named almost exactly alike.
Rhaena is whose kid?
Rhaena is Daemon and Laena's daughter.
So Baela's sister.
Yes. Okay. And she is the one who, last we checked, did not have a dragon. And I believe that is still the case.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah. And so she's the one who hasn't seen Rhaenys in a long time because Baela is the one who is at Driftmark. And it absolutely feels like we are being clowned by the show. I think like specifically when I say we, I think like you and me and our fellow podcasters and all the prognosticators, I think that like Ryan Condal and George R. R. Martin are on the other side of their computer screens listening to this, being like, I can't wait to see how people cover this scene. Are they going to be able to keep everybody in track? I don't know. Rhaenyra, Rhaena, and Rhaenys, all three of them together at last. It's good stuff.
Maybe it's an homage to the Indian action film RRR.
No, it could be.
I don't know.
It could be.
Reading arithmetic. I don't know.
Yes.
But yes, they're all together. Okay. It helps to clarify again So Reyna is one of the little girls who was in that cave when Aemond lost his eye, right?
Okay. Correct. So she was there for that. And it seems like it has been a while since she has seen her grandmother. And it certainly has been some time since Rhaenyra and Rhaenys have had time together. Understandably, considering that Rhaenys believes that Rhaenyra killed her son. And Rhaenyra is fiercely denying it in this scene once Reyna goes away. Rhaenyra says, I loved your son. You may not believe it to be true, but I did. I did not order his death, nor was I complicit in it. I swear this to you. It's, you know, I guess it's the truth, kind of, technically. There's some omission going on.
Yeah, I think there's also an interesting dynamic where, like, in some ways, Rhaenyra agreed to hold a family secret for her dad's cousin, you know, which was like, your son is gay,
right?
And I'm gonna kind of be complicit in covering that up. And so in some ways, I mean, Laenor's imagined death aside, like, Rhaenys kind of owes Rhaenyra a debt of gratitude in a way, and is being, you know, the whole, like, you know, whose children are whose, like, What were Rhaenyra's choices, really? And I don't really think that's what Rhaenys is upset about. Obviously, she thinks that she, you know, that she had Laenor killed. But, like, I don't know. There's just an interesting dynamic between them, because away of other things, like, they're kind of they're very similar. I think they're of the same mind. And that's kind of one of the sad things about this scene, where you're like, maybe they can never reach that understanding. But I think they kind of do later in the episode.
You do get the sense that if these two could get on message with each other, they would be really powerful.
Like, if Rhaenyra could just, like, be like, you can't tell anyone else.
Right.
He's okay. I don't know where he is, but I think he has, like, a loft apartment in one of the free cities.
Yeah. I know that she's trying to save that for her final tribal council speech, right, Richard. Yeah, I do think that this might be, just as we're squeezing down to the final three, it's like final five. Maybe you want to trot it out there so you can win her for your vote when it gets a little tense.
Exactly.
she's trying to make another offer that might be a bit of a stopgap in this tension for at least a moment. She says, listen, if you back Luke tomorrow, we will betroth Laena's children to mine. Bela and Jace will be together. She will be the queen of the Seven Kingdoms someday, and Reyna will rule in Driftmark, and that will pass along to her and Luke's children. So, you know, this will stay in the Valyrian bloodline is, you know, sort of the unspoken piece of this. And Rhaenys is like, that's very generous and also very, very desperate, a stinky cologne. And she says, it's a really nice offer, but you could bargain with me all you like. Tomorrow, Alison Hightower is going to deliver her first blow and force you to your knees, and I will be standing right there. So right now, she doesn't want to hear any of this. And when this falls on deaf ears, Richard, I think this is the moment where Rhaenyra is like, I'm screwed.
I'm getting voted out tonight.
I'm getting voted out tonight. Yes. And so she comes to her father, like the only person that she can possibly appeal to. Right. Like the only person, like her life in the game is in the hands of the one person who does not know how to play it. You know, she's coming to Viserys. And asking him, you know, while it's late at night, he's moaning and groaning his way through the night. And she is being mistaken for Alicent at this moment in time, which is rich, considering the end of the episode. And Rhaenyra is going to ask him about the Song of Ice and Fire. Do you believe that it's true? Are we really supposed to have this duty where we have to hold the realm united against a common foe? Because by naming the heir, you divided the realm. So did you actually believe any of this? And it's storming outside, and she says, I thought I wanted this, but the burden, it's heavy. It's too heavy. And if you wish me to bear it, then you need to defend me and my children. It just feels like sort of this this magical moment. This is like a big moment, I feel like, Richard, where she's like wishing on the thunderstorm for Viserys to have like one last jolt of life to get on his feet. I wrote in my recap to Grandpa Joe his way out of bed and like storm the chocolate factory with her. And like, you have to show up tomorrow. You have to help me. And it's going to work, but it does not feel like it's going to work in this moment.
Yeah, and it's a rare moment of pure vulnerability. You know, like, we've had many scenes on this season of, like, people clearly who are bereft or whatever, but they have to kind of steel themselves, you know, because of who they're talking to or what circumstance they're in. But in this case, it's just, like, a girl and her dying father, and she's just like, I am completely lost, like, please help. And yeah, there's something sort of vaguely... not supernatural, but there's something in the air, you know, of this scene, which I think is really well done. What do we think that Viserys meant by "my only child"?
Yeah, I think that you get it from, you know, as you know, recently as 6 years ago, he's confusing Alicent for Emma. He's going to have the, you know, his potentially final words, right, at the end of this episode, where he sort of like grasps at the night and says, "My love." It feels like he's stuck, you know, or like he is almost like, you know, again, like to invoke lost time travel rules. He's like Minkowski in The Constant, you know, like drifting through time on his deathbed as he is like going back to his proverbial Ferris wheel, and he is being tethered back to his constant, to Emma. And I think that when he says Rhaenyra, my only child, for me, I mean, there's no question that he is the father of Alicent's children. But I think in this moment, he is thinking back, or he's like maybe even really located in that time before all of this. You know, it's just where he wants to go back.
Right.
That was the last time this man was at anywhere even remotely close to happy, you think, is when it was just him, Emma, and Rhaenyra. And that's where he wants to be. And that might be kind of where he's living right now.
Yeah, which again, later on has disastrous consequences.
Yeah,
potentially.
Probably. So the next day, I really loved this imagery. You know, we've seen the model of old Valyria, of course, in the credits every week, but we also see it in Viserys's bedroom throughout the series. And here, like with the candles that are lit to, you know, illuminate the old Valyria model, they're like down to like the very last bits, and it's just the smoking ruins of old Valyria. It feels like the doom is coming. So I just thought that was super evocative, and I loved that choice. It is also very, very evocative to watch Viserys get ready for the day and how many people it requires to sort of clean him up to be quasi-presentable. We see all of the lesions have just gotten worse. The wounds have gotten worse. He, you know, kudos to the visual effects on this episode. I cannot imagine that Paddy Considine Christian Bale'd himself here, Richard.
No.
But it's really effective when you see him just skin and bone is just horrible. It's so horrible. It's so sad to see what this man has become.
Yeah, and yet he still, because of some invented idea of title and succession, has power, you know? And I think that his frailty is kind of a good reminder that this is all made up, you know?
Right.
But, like, there is nothing divine about him. He's human. And, you know, that both kind of, I think, emboldens the people trying to vie for his power, but also, like, should in an ideal world make them think, be like, look, this, we're not going to cheat death with getting this power, we're not going to do anything, it doesn't, you know, we should invent democracy.
Right.
But you know, of course they won't.
No, not even by the end of Game of Thrones. They laugh at it, literally.
Yep.
What are you gonna do? So Otto is recognizing that Viserys is not quite ready for any of this. But I think beyond, like, you know, it's so much less about Viserys is not quite ready for this, and more, it would be so easy to just feed this man more of the milk of the poppy and just put him back to bed. And that would be better, because then we get to make the call. But Viserys shakes his head, and he wants to keep going. But when we arrive in the throne room in the next scene, it feels like at least the show is trying to sell us that Viserys did not make it to the meeting, that he is not going to be coming, because Otto Hightower is speaking on behalf of the crown in his capacity as the Hand of the King, and he will be the one who settles the matter of the succession of Driftmark. And so in this moment, Rhaenyra feels like it's probably a lost cause. She will do what she can. She'll, you know, she'll defend herself as best as she can, but the votes are coming in and it's not in her favor. Baemond gets to speak first and talk about the true unimpeachable Valyrian blood that runs through his veins. Rhaenyra tries to interrupt him and say that my children have that blood as well. Alicent tells her, Baemond gets to talk, you can talk after him. And Baemond very pointedly says to Rhaenyra, I could cut my veins open and show you Valyrian blood and you still would not recognize it. He tells the crown that this is a matter of blood, not ambition, and it's about the continuation of my house above all. It's probably a little bit about ambition, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Everything is, you know, this is opportunity just like anything else, you know.
Yeah, this is at least a little ambition here.
Well, it's like when someone gets medically evacuated from Survivor, someone inevitably says, I'm sad to see them go, but
but that's pretty good for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, like, the flip side is, like, Rainier is like, my father got medevaced and that screwed my game, you know?
Yeah, she's on one of the Blood and Water seasons.
Yeah, I can't believe he left with the idol. He could have given that to me. So what could go wrong indeed? Viserys is going to show up now. And I don't know, maybe there was something in the room this day that I was watching this episode, Richard, but I was very misty-eyed at this entire sequence. I thought that this was really very effective. Viserys coming into the throne room, he is loudly announced, King Viserys of House Targaryen, first of his name, King of the Andals and the Rhoynar and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm. And here he is, you know, hobbling through on his cane, yet on his own 2 feet. He has this golden mask that makes him look part crab feeder, part Phantom of the Opera. And he manages to get to the throne very painfully, but very powerfully, I thought, as he comes up to Otto and the Ramin Djawadi score is soaring underneath all of this. And he says, I will sit the throne today. And Otto steps aside. Your grace, what are you to do? You have to set aside. You have to step aside at this point. His crown drops. Daemon comes, he picks up the crown for him and puts it on Viserys' head. I was full on crying at this point. This was the first time I've cried at House of the Dragon, but I was really moved by this entire sequence.
Well, it's the last gasp of like moderate government, you know?
Right, like, it feels like it.
Whoever takes this role after him is going to have to be much more extreme than he's been. And he managed to kind of hold things at bay for a long time, you know, which is like, you know, he was worrying about his legacy episodes ago. And it's like, I think he kind of weirdly has built one, which was basically just like keeping my asshole family members from killing each other.
Right.
Yeah. So to see him just do one more assertion of himself. It's a big scene.
I think it's Daemon giving him the crown that pushed me over the edge.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking back to obviously all of, like, the horrors that have gone on between these two brothers, but Viserys constantly telling Daemon how much he, you know, like, even every time Daemon screws up, every time he messes up, Viserys is like, just come back. And Daemon last week being the one who wants nothing to do with that. He never wanted his brother's help. And now in this moment, when he and his wife really need Viserys's help, here's Daemon to help Viserys. Like, you have done like 90% of the legwork. Let me get you that last 10% to the throne. But like a moment of growth for the relationship between these brothers, which feels like, good timing considering there might not be much time left for either of them to be with each other anymore. So I thought that was really good. Matt Smith's face just really sold that. And obviously Paddy Considine doing so much work in this episode. And when he steps up and he's just like, he's not like right back to the old version of himself, but he's eloquent enough. I must admit my confusion. I don't understand why petitions are being heard over settled succession. This matters. This is what I was saying earlier, Richard, is like this episode with this matter of the Lord of the Tides, very instructive, right? Because he's not going to be here, Viserys, for too much longer. He knows this. But succession has been settled. His daughter is the heir. She will sit on the Iron Throne after him. It's done. Why are we doing this? And it's like Viserys is getting to time travel, perhaps a little bit, a glimpse into the future that exists beyond him.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it, you're right that he is pretty lucid and well-spoken in this. And it, you know, you get this sort of glimmer of like, okay, like there's still a sane person in authority. And then of course, like he's gone again, you know, and there is something kind of poignant about that, but like, yeah, I think this is the crux moment in a way, weirdly, that we've been kind of waiting for, you know. It's not even about who gets to become king or queen. It's about this other noble house. And yet it has so many far reaching implications.
Rhaenys at this point, I think, you know, reads the room. Viserys is here. She has been offered this deal from Rhaenyra. And if Viserys was strong enough to get to the throne, she's smart enough to know what motivated that.
Right.
So she's like, well, let me just go ahead and take that deal then that Rhaenyra pitched to me. And I will go all the way with that. Luke is the trueborn son of my departed son, Laenor. Corlys wanted this to go to him. And in fact, it's such a great day for all of us. Rhaenyra just told me that we're going to propose my granddaughters. We're going to, have them marry their cousins, their stepbrothers. It's going to be a great time in Westeros. And Viserys says, great, then I could go back to bed. Luke is the heir of the Driftwood Throne, and that is that. Except that's not that for Vaemond Valerion, who decides that now is the time to blow things up. He cannot abide what has gone down, and he lets it be known that this is a catastrophe, that this is catastrophic decision making from Viserys, and he will not stand for it.
Yeah, well, he's not going to stand for much longer. Yeah.
No, really not. He is not. He is making this final pitch. He is getting to have a very HBO death, I think, is what's happening here for Vaemond. I'm thinking of a certain, I won't even speak the name, final season Boardwalk Empire scene, as Vaemond is going to be shouting loudly, peacocking about his being the true Valyrian blood. That is no nephew of mine. Do you know who I am? They are bastards. And she is a whore, he says about Rhaenyra, and Viserys takes out his dagger. He would like spring off of the throne if he could. He does say, I will have your tongue for that. And then Daemon, because this is an action movie all of a sudden, takes out Dark Sister, his Valyrian sword, chops off Vaemond's head from the lower jaw up while his tongue is still wagging. He falls to the ground and Daemon says he can keep his tongue. Like, okay, I've been taken out of it a little bit at this moment in time, but gosh, that was a lot.
Yeah, it's a little cartoony, this part, but like, with, you know, complete with the action movie kiss-off line, but, you know, the show needs that sometimes.
I think so, too.
And I think in the sort of psychological framework of these characters, this world that we're in, I think people will pretty quickly be like, the guy called his wife a whore to the king's face. Like, he was totally justified in having his head cut off by that woman's husband. You know, like,
yeah.
Like, I feel like you're like, there's some sort of logic for them where it's like, yeah, it's a big deal that he killed this noble man, but like, he's a little more noble. And also his family had been grievously insulted.
Yeah, I think that that's it. And I think like they had pushed the envelope multiple times throughout this show of like just like getting right up to the edge of accusing, Rhaenyra's children of being Harwin Strong's children. And finally, someone loudly shouting it, not in like the quasi public forum of Driftmark last week. This is the Red Keep. You know, this is Madison Square Garden. You know, you can't take this back. I think an equally loud announcement. I think for Daemon, probably like worth the risk if they pull swords on me. Like, this can't stand. Like, if we're to show any force of power, I have to make the move that I'm making now. And also, I think no love lost between Daemon and Vaemond. You go back to episode 3 in The War in the Stepstones. They did not seem to care for each other all that much anyway. Daemon was laughing when Vaemond was making his pointed remarks about the Valyrian children last week, too. So I think something of a long time coming for Daemon versus Vaemond. I guess I was surprised, Richard, because I'm used to it being the penultimate episodes of a season 1 of a Game of Thrones franchise where someone loses their head. So this came just like one episode early for me.
Yeah, exactly. They're just shaking things up, you know. You do also wonder that if the Sea Snake is alive and going to come back to this show, which we kind of assume he will, that's not good. You know, like, he's going to be like, he did what to my brother? You know?
Right.
So we have to assume that this beheading will have consequences beyond what we've seen by the end of this episode.
Is that the moment where Daemon should be like, all right, well, so that's the bad news. The good news is your son is alive and I had something to do with that.
Right, exactly. Whoa, just hear me out.
Yeah.
Both of our moms are named Martha, you know.
Right, exactly. We do have this moment afterwards of Rhaenys in the morgue looking over Vaemond's body as the Silent Sisters are washing him and getting him ready to be returned to Driftmark. The Grand Maester tells her, like, maybe you don't want to be here for this. And she says, no, the stranger has visited me more times than I can count. And I assure you, he cares little whether my eyes are open or closed. I thought this was a really compelling scene from the one person on the show who has like so clearly multiple times said, we're just going deeper and deeper into the bear pit. She like is now having eyes on a dead body, yet another dead family member, whether or not she cared much for this man, and realizing like, gosh, we are right in the center of this storm.
Yeah. And you wonder what her next moves are, like where she goes, you know. I think the character and the performance is so good that I wouldn't want her to kind of fade into the background now that she's been not neutralized, but sort of like placated with this marriage arrangement or whatever. Because like she's been the wisest one about this the whole time. And, you know, people didn't listen to her.
Right. I mean, you know, right before this happened, you know, if she could have seen a little bit into the future, maybe she wouldn't have announced the part about my granddaughters being betrothed to Reyna's sons. But that happened first, and then a man died, and it was a sharp reminder of what she is actually pushing herself towards. It's actually kind of interesting when you think about Rhaenys making this move. It feels very Sea Snake. He's so concerned about legacy, and he's so concerned about who the Driftwood Throne will pass down to, and he's the one who cares so much about whether or not he has proximity to the Iron Throne. And it's like this opportunity to have her granddaughters closer to it that Rhaenyra has thrown her way, and Viserys stepping up to the plate and clearly going to be ruling in Rhaenyra's favor. It's almost like some of that old energy before she was the queen who never was, and when she still stood a chance at being just the queen. It's like some of that has reactivated maybe in this moment where she's alone with Daemon. It almost feels like a very quick sobering up on the other side of a relapse.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to think, okay, in some ways she's protecting those kids by having them marry into the inner sanctum, but also that puts them in more risk depending on how things go. And like just the weariness of having to juggle all of those potential outcomes, I think you really feel on Rhaenys in this episode.
So we go to this feast that Viserys wanted, his entire family present. Everyone's here in King's Landing. Who knows when that will happen again, certainly with him still being able to stand. And so he is brought in. There's this big gulf between Rhaenyra and Alicent where Viserys ought to be at the start of it. There is this moment where it looks like they're going to speak with each other just of their own volition before Viserys is brought in. And everyone is toasting to Luke and to Jace and Baela and Rhaena, the strengthening of the houses. Everybody's playing, you know, nice enough at this moment in time. But it's really Viserys' words that I think take it, at least for a time, from nice enough to actually kind of nice. He gives this speech. He tells everybody, it gladdens my heart and fills me with sorrow to see these faces around the table, the faces most dear to me in all the world. You've grown so distant from each other in years past. He takes his mask off. We see his eye is missing. And so we see his face as it truly is for the first time in this episode. He has the line, "My own face is no longer a handsome one, if indeed it ever was. But tonight, I wish you to see me as I am, not just a king, but your father, your brother, your husband, and your grandsire, who may not, it seems, walk for much longer among you. Let us no longer hold ill feelings in our hearts. The crown cannot stand strong if the house of the dragon remains divided." He said the name of the show. "Set aside your grievances, if not for the sake of the crown, then for the sake of this old man who loves you all so dearly." And that is the speech. And for 5 minutes, Richard, it seems like it worked.
Yeah. I mean, he's given a speech like this before, and it worked for a tiny bit, and then it didn't, you know, and... But this one, yeah, it's like this is like one of his final proclamations, you know, and I think people are like, you know what, well, all right, like maybe we can figure this out. And it lasts, you know, till dessert, basically.
Right. Yeah, it's I think everyone in the room is like, yeah, let's look at his true face and we can all, you know, sort of like get closer to what we're all thinking anyway. It's like he is on his way. He is on his way out, and we are on the edge of making a choice. Do we want peace or do we want war? And it feels like Rhaenyra and Alicent in this moment, at least, and probably to Otto's chagrin to a certain degree, when Alicent says, "I raise my cup to you and your house. You will make a fine queen."
Right.
And it seems like the two of them have set it aside, that is their desire in this moment. It feels authentic to me.
Yeah. And part of it, I think, is Rhaenyra's like sees the full picture of how far her father has fallen into poor health. And she's like, good God, Alicent has been taking care of that. You know,
yes.
Like, I think there is just a basic, like, human appreciation for the fact that, like, Alicent, like, stuck by Viserys through a lot of hard and, you know, scary stuff.
Yeah. But even in the immediate aftermath, like, if that's the generation after Viserys, if they're able to get there, then their kin are not quite there yet themselves, as Aegon and Rhaena and Jace are kind of embroiled in a little bit of crosstalk, Aegon saying to Rhaena, "If you ever wish to know what it is to be satisfied, all you have to do is ask." Jace rises, Aemond rises, Jace raises a glass to cover it up. He gives a toast to his uncles, to Aegon and Aemond, and he's just like punching Aegon in the shoulder the whole way through. And then he goes up and dances with Helaena. He sweeps her off her feet as the music strikes up. As Helaena tells Bela and Rhaena what to expect from marriage. Your husband will mostly ignore you, except sometimes when he's drunk. It's not so bad. And Helaena and Jace will start dancing together as Aegon, kind of red-faced, is watching, feeling embarrassed. But the rest of the table is mostly pleasant. You even see like Otto does this like strange little golf clap thing. They're all looking like kind of lovingly at each other. I noted that this felt to me, Richard, like there was a world in which this is the series finale. Like they all figured it out. That's great.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But there's always some tension lurking at the edges. You know, in this case, it's the form of a mean uncle.
Yes, mean Uncle Aemond, because Viserys is watching everybody and he is having this moment of, you can imagine in his mind being like, I did it. All right. I fixed it. I solved everything. I established world peace. And then he is starting to succumb to his illness again and his head is throbbing and his guards have to lift him up and escort him out of the room. And the moment he is gone is the moment that Aemond decides, well, let me just go ahead and break that because we're not actually doing that plan, right? We're still doing plan A, murder everybody. That's still the game plan, right? And he gives his toast to his three nephews, to the nephews. Let us drain our cups to these three strong boys, handsome, wise, and capital S strong.
Right. He's playing a little word, you know, game here.
Mm-hmm.
That I embarrassingly didn't pick up on until the second strong. And I was like, oh, right. Like the last name.
Right.
And, you know, again, with the center of power weak, people feel very emboldened, you know, and he's literally carried out of the room. Viserys is. And so, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And, you know, it's a good kind of clever literary foreshadowing of like what's going to come when, you know, Viserys is really gone. And you know, I don't know what Aemond's like ultimate end game is because we haven't spent enough time with him in this more adult form, but he clearly has absolutely nothing but disdain for most of his extended family.
Yeah. Pretty clear. Yeah. He I mean, and it's rooted in a very real trauma for him, you know. These kids took his eye. You know, he said it was a fair trade, but I'm sure he would love to still have his eye.
It's rooted in that. And I think also, you know, there's interesting generational dynamics now kind of really emerging on the show that the third generation of kids is older.
Right.
And that like Allison and Rhaenyra were raised under Viserys's kind of, you know, poo-pooed or sort of, you know, scoffed at reign of peace, if ineffectualness. And they are softer. You know, they had to kind of, in the earlier episodes of the season, kind of really steel themselves, train themselves into this kind of will to power, this conniving, this scheming, all that. And of course, if they were kind of helping create that world, of course, their children who were completely marinated in it from birth are going to be the ones, you know, there's a kind of more universal tale about like inherited, you know, be it trauma or whatever going on in the show.
Yeah, I think that it's exactly right that like from birth, you know, and in many ways, some of these kids exist literally, were created literally for the purpose of war,
right
you know, like for this war for the crown. So yeah, of course, for some of them at least, the lesson was really going to take, and for Aemond it seems like it has sunk all the way deep to the roots. And he's the one who is like saying to Allison, like, I was just saying how proud I am of my family. It seems as though my nephews aren't as proud of theirs. And there's almost a fight between Daemon and Aemond. That would have been interesting to see the two of them exchange words, but it does not come to that. And Allison comes to Rhaenyra, and she's the one who's trying to be like, please don't leave. Don't go back to Dragonstone. We can fix this. And Rhaenyra kind of takes her up on that to a degree, it sounds like. She says, well, let me take my children home because I do not feel like they are safe here, but I'll come back. I will fly my dragon back and we can hang out. And Allison says, the king and I would both love that.
I'll take the Delta shuttle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take
the red eye home.
Yeah.
So again, still the possibility of peace at this moment in time, as dinner is wrapping up. There's a very quick scene of someone who was witness to all of this coming to Missaria. If we remember Missaria, we have not seen her in quite some time. Damon's lover once upon a while, who now seems to be in something of a power broker position here in Westeros, no affiliation with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And she hears that it's been quite a night at the castle. We really get no further elaboration on this, but scene's not in here without a reason, I think it's fair to say.
I think that's...
It feels like it.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like it, yeah. But... So, TBD on what's going to happen with Missaria. We get to the final scene of the episode, and it is Alicent bringing Viserys to bed. He is really struggling. She's trying to help him, get comfortable. And this is the time that Viserys responds to who he believes is Rhaenyra, asking him the question from earlier about the Song of Ice and Fire. He says, "You wanted to know if I believe it to be true. Don't you remember Aegon, his dream, the Song of Ice and Fire? It is true. What he saw in the north, the prince that was promised, the prince to unite the realm against the cold and the dark. It is you. You are the one. You must do this. You must do this." Tragically, he is conveying this information to the wrong person. He believes he is speaking to Rhaenyra, who earlier he thought was Alicent. Now it is Alicent, and she receives that information as it is conveyed to her, Richard. She walks away from this thinking, "I understand, my king." And it's like, all right, I guess I got to go back into the shit.
Yes. And, you know, one significant thing about this, at least if I'm remembering correctly, is that this is secret mythology. This is secret lore that is only kind of shared in very privileged conversations within, the royal scheme. And so Alicent doesn't even have any context clues for this. She's never heard
of it. Does
about
not
this.
Seem like it. Right.
You know, and so there's that kind of miscommunication. There's the obvious miscommunication of who Viserys thinks he's talking to. But there's also, like, he's being kind of vague in a way. Like, she, you know, but I mean, my interpretation is that she's like, his dying wish was that he's undoing what he promised to Rhaenyra, basically.
Right. And I think not for nothing, again, about the name confusion, you know, he says, "Don't you remember Aegon, his dream?" If she has no context for what the hell he's talking about, she doesn't know he's talking about Aegon the Conqueror, their firstborn son, who, if she has her way, is the king of Westeros following Viserys, is Aegon. He's talking about our son. He needs to be the one. He needs to unite the realm. You must do this. You must put him on the throne. So she is now sort of like imbued with what she probably takes away as like something of this holy purpose, you know, that the Hightower cause is indeed true and just and is not just sort of like this imagined plot, but we actually have to go through with it. So, in his penultimate act, Richard, Viserys nearly stopped a war from happening. And it seems like if this is indeed his ultimate act, and it very much reads that way to me, that he may have forced it past the point of no return.
Yeah, a testament to his kind of inevitable ineptness, you know, that we saw again and again in his run. But, you know, if Alicent had just named her son like George or something, this would have been avoided entirely.
It would have cleared it up.
It's like, you ever seen the movie Shattered Glass where there's a scene where Peter Sarsgaard's walking in to like have the final reckoning about the plagiarism? And the receptionist says, "Pictures." And he says, "What?" He said, "Pictures. If you put pictures in the magazine, none of this could have happened." And I'm like watching the show and it's like different names. If you just named them differently, like this confusion would be entirely moot.
Yes. Shattered dragon glass is where we are at this moment in time. If this is Viserys's final moment, his final words, as we're sort of lingering with him in bed while he's alone, a single tear running down his cheek. He reaches up at the sky, the screen goes black, and he says, "My love." If this is it for Viserys Targaryen, Richard, final words on Paddy Considine and his contributions to this show.
Well, Considine succeeded admirably. Viserys attempted admirably and failed, sadly.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
By no fault of his own. He was in an addled state, obviously. And also, Alicent didn't go in there with, I think, nefarious intention, you know, and she just thinks she heard what she heard, you know, and Viserys is a really complicated, tragic figure, a little Shakespearean, a little bit more modern, Yeah, well done. Not he had a much different arc than I thought he would. So I like being surprised.
Yeah, what I really love about the way that this show treats Viserys Targaryen, knowing what the premise of House of the Dragon is, it's going to be the succession show, right? So like clearly like the long-term view is Viserys Targaryen can't be on the throne forever, otherwise the show never gets to be what it's supposed to be. That I think, you know, you look at Viserys, sort of his positioning in the story in season one, very similarly to a Ned Stark. The difference being in Game of Thrones season one, you don't expect to lose Ned Stark. That's a surprise. It's a big twist. You're now trained as a person who's been through 8 seasons of Game of Thrones to expect the worst to happen to these characters. So I think that the surprise for Viserys has not been like, is he going to die or not? It has felt inevitable from, you know, before the first scene of the series. You know, it has felt inevitable from the trailers, from the moment you hear a word about what the storyline is. The surprise has been like how long he made it, how far he has come, and how long he has lasted, and what that longevity has meant to the tensions. Like the right. fact that he has been in that position for so long has just left this this sauce has been reducing, and it is deep and it is unctuous, and we are potentially ready to drink from it as we move forward into the penultimate episode of House of the Dragon next week, Richard, titled The Green Council.
Oh, okay. So, Allison, big episode for her, I'm predicting, or for Otto.
Hightower Green!
Yep. Maybe we'll go Hightower to Old Town. Green. Who knows?
That would be fun. I think that's going to do it for us here on Still Watching this week. Unless you have any parting thoughts about The Lord of the Tides, Richard, I thought another really great episode of the show.
A great episode of the show. I think just to your last kind of point, like you do think if he had just collapsed when these people were all children, if Viserys had just died then and these grandkids weren't yet men grown who are capable of great violence, maybe this would have been an easier, if still difficult, transition. But now, like, great that he lasted this long, but I think it's exacerbated the situation.
We'll see how the situation unravels next week when we get into the Green Council. We would love to hear from all of you out there if you've got thoughts on The Lord of the Tides and how it is setting us up for these final 2 episodes of season 1 of House of the Dragon. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. That is the way to send in your feedback. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Richard, where can people find you? What do you got going on here on Vanity Fair?
I'm on Twitter at Rylaws and just the usual reviews and whatnot on VF.com.
Amazing. I'm at Round Howard, wherever you can find me. I am recapping House of the Dragon here on VF.com every single week, including next week when we return to discuss episode 9, The Green Council. Huge shout out to the great Dave Gonzalez for making this podcast possible this week. Until next time, everybody, we will be back soon to discuss episode 9 of House of the Dragon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.